Question two is starts out at least as a kind of offer and acceptance problem. And while some of you chose not to discuss it, there is in fact an interesting offer and acceptance issue in the course of these facts. At her home, Bertram said to Sarah, "I will offer you the sum of $125,000 for your house." Sarah Seller, the facts say, responded that she really thought the house was worth at least $150,000 and hoped that he would think more about it. Now, that was the end of the conversation at her house. The next day, Sarah calls Bertram, and she says to him that she would accept his offer of $125,000. Now, if that offer was still available, then Sarah could legitimately argue that there is a purchase and sale agreement for Bertram to buy her house for $125,000. Now, that is not as good a price as Sarah would like to have, but let's keep in mind that our task is to come up with arguments that maximize, insofar as we can, Sarah's position, and we will make alternative arguments to do it. But one of the arguments we can certainly make is that the contract is to purchase for $125,000, not $100,000. That, in fact, that while there was a continuation of that conversation in which there was an apparent agreement for a purchase and sale at $100,000, if there was, in fact, an existing contract for $125,000, that second so-called agreement, in fact, lacked consideration. Now, that doesn't give Sarah everything she'd like, but at least it would give her $125,000 instead of $100,000. So that's a first argument. A second argument, of course, and many of you, but not all of you, saw this, was that this is a sale of real estate. And the statute of frauds, as we learned, includes as one of the categories requiring a writing any sale of real estate or transaction in real property. And this was a transaction in real property. Please notice that this contract, if there was one, has to do with the sale of real estate. It does not have to do with a transaction in goods. The Uniform Commercial Code is totally irrelevant to this transaction. However, the statute of frauds does require all transactions in land to be in writing. This was not in writing. That does not mean the contract is void. There is a contract, but the contract is not enforceable against Sarah, because there is no writing. Now, Bertram will try to argue that there is a writing, and he will point to the material in Sarah's house handed to him by Sarah when he entered the house, when he first saw it, and he will argue that that really represents a writing, an offer for sale. The difficulty with this argument is that it describes not the transaction which he was engaged in with her ultimately, but rather a transaction which he rejected. And so I doubt very much that he will be able to argue that there is anything in writing from Sarah upon which he can base his action. Assuming, however, that for whatever reason the statute of frauds is not available to Sarah, Sarah can defend against the enforcement of the purchase of the house for $100,000 by arguing that her acceptance for $100,000 as the purchase price was based on a unilateral mistake on her part about her septic system situation. You will recall that under the question, she believed that she had a system that was out of compliance with city law, and that the visit by the city sewer people was really an indication to her that she could be in serious trouble over the circumstances of her house, the code compliance of her house. That, of course, was a mistake. It was a unilateral mistake, but even assuming that it was a unilateral mistake, most courts today will, under certain circumstances, relieve a party who is unilaterally mistaken. Now, one of the grounds upon which they will relieve that person who is engaged in a unilateral mistake is in a situation in which the other party, the non-mistaken party, has reason to know of the mistake and yet says nothing to correct it and has done little or nothing to rely upon it, and it would be unconscionable to go ahead and enforce the contract. And I think that Sarah could make arguments that all of those criteria are met one by one. That is, the unconscionability of it, the fact that he knew, it seems to be clear. The only reliance he could conceivably argue is that he spent $100 arranging with the sewer department to go ahead and inspect the property. But interestingly enough, he spent that $100 before he had actually come to an agreement with Sarah about the purchase of the house, and therefore he cannot argue that the reliance, that he spent the $100 in reliance upon the contract. Now, Sarah has an alternative argument that there was a mutual mistake. It's a weaker argument, probably, but she can argue that both she and Bertram were mistaken with respect to the question of whether or not the house depended upon a septic system. The difficulty, of the course, with this is that he was probably not operating under such an illusion, although he certainly did not communicate to her that he didn't share her view. Still another argument that Sarah will make, and it's related to a previous one, is that the contract for $100,000 was reached as a result of Bertram Breyer's fraud, or at least, if not fraud, at least it was a failure to disclose information that he knew and that he knew that Sarah did not have. Now, that raises, of course, the question of when is there a duty to disclose. And many members of the class simply wrote that there was a duty of good faith and that he had breached it. Well, not so quick. It's not so easy as that. We saw that the duty is not to bargain in good faith. Rather, the duty is to perform in good faith, as currently understood. The only instances in which we read that there was a duty to bargain in good faith were in circumstances in which the parties had reached an intermediate level of agreement, a letter of intent, for example, and there some courts have stated that the parties from that point onward have a duty to bargain in good faith. Instead, one must argue that under all of the facts and circumstances, there was a duty to disclose, and that duty to disclose would be predicated upon an understanding that he had come about with knowledge that he knew she did not have, and that it was material, and that would materially influence the price and value of the house. He will argue, on the other hand, that this was information which was common. Everyone could have gotten it. He did nothing to hide it. He simply said nothing about it. But this was a matter of public information. He had learned it simply by taking the time and making the effort to go and talk to the sewer department, and that's where he learned about the sewer line being put in. She could have done the same thing, and under those circumstances, he should not be required to disclose it or suffer any sanction for his non-disclosure. Finally, the question indicates that Bertram would like to have specific performance. And I was interested to note that some of you were prepared to allow him specific performance, arguing that there was no mistake, or the mistake that she made, that the onus and responsibility and risk were on her. And you said that if the statute of frauds was not a defense, then he would be entitled to specific performance. It seemed to me that there was a substantial argument made here that even if the court did not think that there was an obligation to disclose, the way in which he behaved falls well short of an equitable description of having clean hands. He had no clean hands in this transaction. He was clearly out to take advantage of a circumstance which had led Sarah to believe that she had to sell the house at a price much lower than its true market value. And under those circumstances, she has a clear defense to specific performance. It's not necessarily a defense to enforceability of the contract, but it is a defense to the equitable action for specific performance.